Welcome back. Last time, I talked about the collapse of Mayan states in Mesoamerica. The questions that archaeologists have in this case involve the extent and mechanisms of that collapse, the ways in which it happened. We ask ourselves whether ecological or social factors, or some combination of the two, were to blame. Of course, one of the things that my writing allows us is some extra insight into the processes by which this collapse happened. I have to note, of course, that this did not involve the total demise of Mayan elite culture and practices. These persisted, especially in the northern Yucatan Peninsula, albeit in a primarily non-urban form, perhaps in part conditioned by environmental limitations there compared to the Maya heartland. This form of Maya elite culture was eventually ended by the Spanish occupation of Mexico. I also want to note, I want to emphasize as well, that this did not, the Maya collapse did not mean the end, certainly did not mean the end of Maya occupation of their lands in Mesoamerica. That occupation continued. There are Maya people living in these regions today. It was the collapse of a particular form of Mayan civilization, of a regional elite culture and urbanism characteristic of the first millennium AD. I now want to move on to the last region of the world that we will examine in this set of lectures, the Pacific coast of South America, and for today, particularly, especially the development of agriculture in that region. This area was, of course, ultimately home to the Inca Empire, brought down, like the last remnants of Maya civilization, brought down eventually by the Spaniards. But this region also saw astonishingly precocious political developments, thousands of years before that. Political developments, social developments that have only recently been recognized by archaeologists. So this is a region, again, of great academic and intellectual ferment for archaeologists because our views of the South American past are changing so dramatically through time. One of the concepts that archaeologists use in these areas along the Pacific coast of South America is the concept of vertical integration, the ways in which human communities can make use of resources from different environmental zones, separated not so much by great distances, but rather separated by altitude. Agriculture and political developments along the Pacific coast of South America occurred in contexts of great environmental difference, from the teeming fisheries just off the coast in the Pacific to the heights of the Andes. Populations in this region exploited the opportunities of these very different resources from very early times. We can imagine that this variety of resources is not so obviously available or not available at such close proximity in many of the areas we've looked at. This vertical distribution of resources means that people can exploit different environments without actually traveling that far on the ground. In many of the other areas that we've looked at, this is not so easily done, although perhaps in the eastern Mediterranean, where, again, we have the close proximity of different kinds of land and marine resources, this would be a possibility. The regional economic and cultural adaptations used to exploit these different environments are also something that we've seen before. Thus, for example, in Mesopotamia, we looked at the significant relationship, the close relationship between pastoralism and farming. And pastoralism and farming in this case, in the Mesopotamia case, are complementary economic strategies. Between them, they allow a more efficient and more productive exploitation of environments than either of these economic strategies allows in and of itself. So we're going to see very, very similar relationships in South America between, for example, fishing populations on the coast of Peru and Chile and Ecuador, and farming occupations in dry river valleys in the interior, away from the coast. For various reasons that we'll go into over the next few lectures, this seems to have generated economic adaptations and also political responses not really seen in other parts of the world. And that's what makes this region so fascinating. There is, for example, a debate among archaeologists about the roles that maritime resources may have played in sustaining social hierarchy and political centralization along the Pacific coast of South America, and especially in Peru and Chile. And this is a debate that really doesn't exist anywhere else in the world in the same form. It's really the only area where we see archaeologists wondering about the role of maritime resources in the development of states. Thus, at sites along the north coast of Chile, at places like Las Conchas, Caleta Abtao, and Quinaca, by 7500 BC, people were exploiting the potentials of coastal resources, especially shellfish, various kinds of fish, seals, and sea lions. Now, in many different parts of the world, areas as diverse as Scandinavia, Japan, the northwest coast of North America, and East Africa, the productivity and reliability of littoral zones, those areas by the seaside, productivity and reliability of littoral zones of this kind encouraged hunter-gatherer populations to settle in more permanent communities even before the development of agriculture. Now, we know this. This is a well-understood archaeological phenomenon, an ethnographic phenomenon as well. These resources are so rich and so reliable that people can settle for relatively long periods of time before agriculture, before farming's ever developed. This is the case, certainly. I've already spoken of small-scale societies along the northwest coast of North America, for example, where we see political organization, I would say at least at the chiefdom level, to use that somewhat abused term, sustained by fishing. The question here, then, is what role can we expect maritime resources to play in the development of states? And what will their role be vis-a-vis agricultural resources? So by about 6000 BC, people on or near the Pacific coast in South America, through Peru, through Chile at least, were living in at least semi-permanent settlements, as, for example, at the site of Paloma, near the central coast of Peru. While the houses at Paloma were light and probably portable, fish drying racks and storage pits indicate that the settlement was actually inhabited for significant periods of time. The economy of the site of Paloma was centered on fishing and shellfish gathering, supplemented by the harvesting of a variety of wild plants, with domesticated squash and beans added to the diet before about 4000 BC. As we might expect from our examination of other areas of the world, There's no evidence for any marked differences in social status or wealth in this small-scale community. Between about 4000 BC and 3000 BC, this economic strategy, concentrating on marine resources but making use of a variety of other kinds of resources as well, this economic strategy continued to develop on and near the Pacific coast during this time from southern Ecuador to northern Chile. In general, these coastal populations made extensive use of both the resources of the ocean and the resources of the rivers flowing into the ocean, and particularly fish and shellfish. Populations seem to have increased significantly over much of the area through this time, and it appears that settlements became more substantial and more permanent in many areas. So we've got probably an increasing development and increasing sophistication in economic systems, larger populations, and more permanent settlements. The primary economic advance, economic development over this period, was the appearance of domesticated plants on many sites, as at Paloma. However, this is where it gets interesting, because the form that agriculture took along the Pacific coast of South America varied somewhat from that we've seen in other parts of the world that we've looked at up until this point, except perhaps in Mesoamerica. Because this early development of agriculture in South America does not seem to have been based around a major cereal crop. Instead, coastal populations either planted or encouraged the growth of a wide variety of indigenous crops, including beans, peppers, achira, which is a flowering plant with a starchy rhizome, and gourds. It's unclear in some cases whether these species were actually planted or whether they were merely protected and watered after they sprouted naturally. Plants in this latter category that are not actually sown by humans but are protected and encouraged after they appear on their own are called by archaeologists semi-domesticates. And this is actually a widespread class of plant foods in different parts of the world. We find populations all over the world who are really depending to a significant degree on plants that they may not be planting themselves, but that they're encouraging once they begin to grow. And this, to an extent, confounds our distinction, the distinction we usually make between domesticated plants on the one hand and wild plants on the other. These semi-domesticates are growing with a great deal of human intervention, but they're not actually being planted by humans. South American populations are also making use of a lot of different kinds of wild plants at the same time, not semi-domesticates, but just plants that they're gathering in the environment. One thing to remember here is that these plants, this wide variety of different plant foods, would address some of the significant challenges that reliance on maritime resources can pose for human populations. An entirely marine diet can leave people critically short on starches and, in some cases, fat. And this needs to be supplemented with other foods. And in addition, it's likely that exploitation of seals and fatty fish like anchovies would help in this as well. But this is a real issue for populations that are really dependent upon marine diets. Arguably, the most important agricultural crop for these coastal communities wasn't a plant food at all, but rather cotton. cotton seems to have been domesticated on a number of occasions in both the Old and New Worlds. It's evidently a very, very useful plant. Well, it's obviously a very useful plant. It was domesticated in the Indus Valley, for example, during Harappan times, if not before. It was domesticated possibly in parts of Africa. And Pacific coastal populations in South America before 5000 BC probably made use of wild forms of cotton. However, the cotton in use in these communities by 4000 BC was probably domesticated. Now, we tend to think of cotton as a material for clothing. But along the Pacific coast in South America in the 4th millennium BC, cotton transformed societies through its use in fishing nets, in baskets, in fibers, and in artifacts made with fibers. These, and especially nets, would have allowed significantly more efficient fishing practices. One major question for archaeologists during this period is the role of corn. It's a cereal crop. Archaeologists, as I said, love cereal crops. We're always looking for ancient cereals when we're considering how agriculture developed in different parts of the world. As I mentioned in an earlier lecture, corn was probably available to coastal populations in Ecuador, at least in the 5th millennium BC, and it would gradually spread further to the south. By 3500 BC, people were settled in permanent villages along river valleys near the coast of southern Ecuador as part of what's known as the Valdivia culture. We know archaeologically that Valdivia populations grew corn as well as other domesticates. We know that they made the first pottery discovered to this point in this part of the New World, in this part of South America. We know that they probably participated in trading relations with communities further inland. Perhaps most importantly, from our point of view, though, Valdivia sites like Rio Alto show evidence of plazas and public buildings, places where members of the community, probably high-status members of the community, would have gathered together for communal feasts and for ritual activities. There's as yet little evidence for important differences in wealth or power within these Valdivia communities. But we can see at these sites a process beginning that we've seen in action in other parts of the world. Contemporary communities further to the south in Peru seem to have been somewhat smaller and simpler during this period, but as we're going to see in the next lecture, that would change. So we have a set of processes going on along the coast. What about further inland? The highlands of the Andes offered different challenges and different resources to settlers when compared to coastal areas. There's evidence of hunting populations in Andean sites before 10,000 years ago. But more important for the purpose of this lecture has been the archaeological discoveries at Guerrero Cave in northern Peru, where domesticated beans are dated to somewhere between about 8500 and 5500 BC. And these are among the earliest domesticated beans in the New World. A great variety, of other indigenous tubers and related crops are also found on sites in the highlands, including luco, lucumo, and oca. These may at the time have been domesticated or protected semi-domesticates. Now, the variety of these indigenous plants is really startling beyond the very well-known potato, and the potato is easily the best-known domesticate to have come from these Andean agricultural systems. But the diversity of Andean food plants, Andean domestication systems, is certainly comparable to that of, for example, the Ethiopian plateau in northeastern Africa, both in their variety and their unfamiliarity beyond the region. We just have a variety of plant crops originating in the Andes that are in constant use in the region today, but relatively unknown beyond the Andes. And it's never at all clear why some plants are so successful in these circumstances and are adopted widely beyond their area of origin. Take the potato, for example, and others are not. The earliest domesticated potatoes themselves come from sites around Ayacucho in the Andes and date to about 3800 BC. The only large animals to be domesticated in the New World were also tamed in the Andean highlands. These were the native camelids, including llamas and alpacas, and they were probably domesticated in the 3rd millennium BC. And really the only large domesticates in all of the New World. These would be extremely valuable to Andean populations, especially as sources of meat and fiber. Remember, I noted that Mesoamerican populations, for example, didn't have access to such domesticated animals as sources of meat. These camelids, and particularly llamas, would also be used as beasts of burden. But they were never used as extensively in these roles as in the Old World, nor were they used in the kinds of transformative roles, for example, for riding, as traction animals, as plow animals, as we see in the Old World. As we shall see in the next lecture, the Andean highlands are not the area to see the first developments towards states and civilizations in South America. That will happen along the Pacific coast of Ecuador, Peru, and Chile. However, the domestication of a varied and vital set of plant and animal species provided the basis for a sophisticated system of economic and cultural interchange between the coastal plains on the one hand and the Andean highlands on the other. This productive interchange would provide much of the dynamic for political centralization in later periods. And this is the concept of verticality that I mentioned earlier. One important element here then will obviously be the nature of trade and exchange relationships between the Andes and the coast. We know they existed. We have some archaeological evidence for them, but to this point they have not been greatly investigated. It's likely, though, that this form of interchange between coast and highlands is one of the reasons that river valleys running from the Andes to the Pacific coast are going to be a focus of cultural and political developments along the Pacific coast of South America for thousands of years, well beyond the fact that these river valleys are themselves fertile in generally semi-arid environments. So we're now coming to one of the most contentious questions in South American archaeology, one that sparked debate for the last 30 years, and it's always interesting to see when a particular idea from a particular archaeologist will have everyone reacting, everyone talking and debating and arguing about cultural changes in prehistory. In the mid-1970s, Michael Mosley, an American archaeologist working along the Pacific coast of Peru, advanced his Maritime Foundations hypothesis that the earliest developments towards civilization in this part of South America between about 3000 BC and 1800 BC were sustained primarily by exploitation of maritime resources, including shellfish, but especially the fantastically rich anchovy fisheries just off the Pacific coast. According to Mosley, agricultural production, except for the production of cotton to make fishing nets and line, would have been of lesser importance than the fisheries. And this is interesting. Archaeologists would not expect to see such a process. We're conditioned to look to agriculture, and as I said, particularly cereal agriculture, as the basis of any large-scale social system. This is particularly true for the complex, centralized, hierarchical societies that we associate with state formation and civilization. Could it be true that along the Pacific coast of South America, progress toward the state was not based on corn or perhaps potatoes, but rather on anchovies? As I noted, we're willing to accept that for chiefdoms, perhaps, in different areas along the northwest coast of North America and so on, this might happen. But the question is, how far can societies go along the pathway to states through such a dependence on maritime resources? In many parts of this region, archaeological and bioanthropological data suggest that corn was not a major component of the diet, even where it's found. So we have to distinguish between the appearance of corn on archaeological sites and its significance in local diets. So that it appears that even in some areas where it's found, it wasn't that significant in local diets. It may have been used actually to brew beer. Now, this can't be underestimated. Beer consumption, and particularly communal consumption of alcoholic beverages, is a political, social, and ritual activity of great importance in many areas of the world. It can be used, for example, in the area I work in. Communal production of beer is one way of organizing communal work parties without which agricultural systems cannot function. But this is not quite the stuff of the staff of life. Now, it's true that the periodic El Niño oceanic phenomenon can disrupt the supplies of anchovies and related fish near the coast of Peru, which could be catastrophic for populations dependent upon these resources. And this has been advanced as an objection to Mosley's Maritime Foundation's hypothesis. Of course, the other way of looking at this is that the flooding that El Niños typically cause on land could be equally disruptive to farming systems and is indeed blamed for the collapse of later cultures in the region. It might also be the case that the staple agricultural crop in this region was not corn, but rather potatoes and related tubers from the highlands. These could not have been grown along the Pacific coast of South America at that time, but they might have been brought down the rivers that flow from the Andes to the ocean, which would, as I noted, suppose an efficient regional trading network by perhaps the 4th millennium BC. At this point, debate about Mosley's Maritime Foundation's hypothesis continues. It seems, at the very least, that staple cereal crops like corn were somewhat less important in this region of the New World, with a great diversity of local domesticates and semi-domesticates and the immense resources of the Pacific Ocean being exploited as well. We'll examine the consequences of these economic advances in the next lecture. Thank you.